Good morning, brothers and sisters. Very nice to be with you. I have two sisters. My younger sister, Jane, has a boy called Johnny Robinson, who wrote that song that we just sang, which I'm always quite moved when we sing. And I have another sister called Sally, who has a son called Tom. And I was told last night that he's just been appointed as the senior advisor to Dominic Perrottet. He's a keen Christian boy, Tom. So I'm very thankful for these nephews, and it's nice to know that Dominic Perrottet has quite a fine evangelical boy for his senior advisor. Anyway, we have prayed, and I wanted you to notice that there is a tenuous link between the humorous story that I attempt to tell you sometimes and the talk that is about to follow. And because Rod and some others played golf yesterday, I thought I would just begin by telling you a favourite story of mine, and please stop me if you've heard this before, but have you heard the story before of the meeting between Tiger Woods and Stevie Wonder in a pub? Have you heard this story before? So Tiger Woods, the great golfer, Stevie Wonder, the blind singer, meet in a pub, and Stevie Wonder says to Tiger Woods, you know, when my drive is off, my whole game is off. And Tiger Woods said, what are you talking about? You're blind, you can't play golf. And Stevie Wonder said, of course I can play golf. I get my caddy to wait down the fairway, and he calls to me, and I hit towards him. And then when we get to the green, he stands behind the pin, and he calls to me, and I putt towards him, and it's working really well, and I'm playing off scratch. Tiger Woods said, that's incredible. We must have a game sometime. And Stevie Wonder said, nobody takes me seriously. I won't play for less than $1,000 a hole. And Tiger Woods said, well, that'd be fine. Let's have 18 holes sometime. And here's the punchline. And Stevie Wonder said, you pick a night. Now, here's the tenuous link between what we're about to do. Would it not be wonderful, since we now go back to work, all of us, and we go blindly back to the work in a way, don't we? We don't exactly know what's in front of us. And we don't exactly know what's down the road in life. Would it not be wonderful to have a voice that you could trust, that you could keep walking towards, when there are so many voices that are confusing us and so many in our heads that are distressing us? There is one voice, isn't there, that just continually speaks reason and wisdom and grace to us. And that, of course, is the voice of the Lord in the Word. So we're turning to the last section of Deuteronomy this morning, and I wanted to also mention to you that there is a book which I strongly recommend you get if you can, called Some Pastors and Teachers by Sinclair Ferguson. I think it's the Banner of Truth have put together his papers into one volume. And if you find yourself at the moment quite stale in your Christian life, and quite flat, and you just long for something to stretch you and genuinely stimulate you, because everything is so bland and dull and dead, this book called Some Pastors and Teachers is a collection of Sinclair Ferguson's little mini articles on things like the prayer life of John Calvin or John Owen's view of the Holy Spirit. And all the chapters are about 8 pages. And it's a terrific collection. And I would say, like many of you, I read a lot, and it would probably be one of the best 2 or 3 books I've read in the last 10 years. So buy it if you want to stimulate and stretch yourself, like a theological workout. It's a great book, Some Pastors and Teachers, by Sinclair Ferguson. We have seen the recap of Deuteronomy, chapters 1 to 4. We've seen the covenant chapters, 5 to 11. We've seen a little bit of the details of the unpacking of what I think is the unpacking of the commandments. And we come now to the section 27 to 34, which is the decision time, where Moses is calling on God's people to make a response. In other words, are you going to be a God-fearing, Bible-believing, Bible-doing people? That's the question. Now, dear brothers and sisters, this section of Deuteronomy is a great section to consider some careful reading of and study if you want to rethink your evangelism. In other words, here is Moses at his best trying to get people to respond. And if you think that's a big issue and an important issue, it's worth studying how Moses does it. So 27 to 34 is Moses modeling evangelism. I've talked to you about studying 5 to 11 as a study of the covenant relationship. But here, 27 to 34, is Moses modeling evangelism. We know, of course, that it's the work of God to regenerate people. We could preach till our tongue fell out, as Spurgeon once said, and nothing would happen unless God is at work to convert people. We know from John 16 that it's the Spirit who convicts. We know from 2 Corinthians 7 that it's the Spirit of God who causes a real repentance. We know from Acts 16, the story of Lydia, that he's the one that opens the heart. We know from Acts 2 that it's God who causes people to say, "What must I do?" But God uses us. He uses us to persuade and to convince. And some people, of course, have a very great gift of doing this. I mean, Billy Graham was raised up with this remarkable ability to get people to cross a line. And if those of you who listened to John Chapman knew that he had very great persuasive powers humanly, but it's God who does the work. However, we are called on, as we know, to preach the word, which is the sharper than a two-edged sword, and is going to wonderfully change people's minds, hearts, and lives. So keep going with that. So let's think about this. In Deuteronomy 27, he tells the people, we didn't read this, that when they crossed the Jordan River, which they're about to cross, that they had to set up 12 large stones. And the 12 large stones, I presume, on the west side of the river, are stones which I guess they're going to collect as they cross the river. So I wonder whether they're going to collect 12 big stones from the bed of the riverbed and set them up on the bank, and they're to paint them white and they're to write law on the white painted rocks. This would be a reminder to them, of course, that it was a miracle that they got into the promised land. But it would also be a reminder to them of the law which God had given them. And when they enter the land, Moses says in Deuteronomy 27, there'll be two mountains like doorposts, the mountain called Gerizim and the mountain called Ebal. And on the mountain of Gerizim, they're to call out the blessings, and on the mount of Ebal, they're to call out the curses. You'll notice if you look at chapter 27, and I'm not asking you to look at chapter 27 now, but if you do, you'll see that the curses are very general. It just says you'll be cursed if you do this, you'll be cursed if you do this, but it doesn't say what the curses are. And the sins are relational, bad behavior within relationships. That's Deuteronomy 27. That's my introduction. In your outline, which you've been given, we're now going to think about what I've called pros and cons in Deuteronomy 28. And in Deuteronomy 28, it's a very long chapter, 68 verses. He has some blessings and some curses. Now, the blessings are very specific. What Moses is saying is, if you heed the word of God, God will bless you, and you'll have lots of crops and lots of herds, and you'll have great victories and great prosperity and lots of rain. You know, again, that the sign of Old Testament blessing was very outward and material. The sign of New Testament blessing is very inward and eternal. Then, after the early verses of Deuteronomy 28, the blessings, we come to the curses, and the curses go forever. From verses 15 to 68, what is that? 53, 54 verses of curses. And the curses are everything that is the opposite of God's favor. He says you're going to fail if you disobey. You'll have poverty, you'll be barren, there'll be diseases, there'll be dust, you'll be defeated by your enemies, you'll be captives, you'll be given to idolatry, the city will be sieged, you'll fall into despair. He's piling on the warnings here. And the principle is that if you turn your back on God, your Savior, the creation will turn against you. And you'll go back to Egypt, not literally, but, you know, there'll be locusts and there'll be darkness and there'll be plagues. So here is Moses. He's setting up a kind of a division. Do you want to go down the road of blessing where things will go well for you because God's favor will be with you? Or do you want to go down the road of cursing where you're going to be rebellious and God is going to have to discipline you in a serious way? As we read this chapter, I think we ought to ask the question whether this has any bearing on us today at all. In other words, can we see God's hand in the plenty that comes to the land or the poverty that comes to the land today? Should farmers read Deuteronomy 28 and learn how to have prosperity? Well, my answer, I think, is that God may teach us all sorts of lessons, driving us to trust him. But these promises really relate to Israel and the promised land. We can't just borrow them into the Christian life. We cannot create an equation from these verses straight to the Christian life. We cannot interpret what's going on with drought or plenty unless God gives us an interpretation, and he doesn't give us an interpretation, a specific interpretation. We're told in the Bible that rain falls on the just and the unjust. We're told, of course, or it's quite clear, isn't it, that drought comes to the just and the unjust. What we are told in the Bible, Genesis 9, is that there won't be a flood that will flood the earth. So the vital issue, I think, that we want to be saying to people all the time is, the real danger that you need to avoid are the curses of being cut off from God in the present and the future. And the real blessings that you need to take hold of are being connected to God in the present and the future. In other words, we're commending people to Jesus, and we're commending Jesus to people. We're telling people that the most important curse to avoid is the curse of being condemned. And the most important blessing to receive is the blessing of being reconciled. And we're able to remind people, aren't we, that Jesus, in Galatians chapter 3, bore the curse so that we might receive the blessing. But everything else to do with poverty and rain and harvest and success and crops and herds, we don't really have a specific interpretation on that. We can only say that God is at work teaching us all sorts of things in all sorts of different ways. Does that make sense? I'm trying to grapple with this from a New Covenant perspective. So God, you see, may humble people in order to seek him by making things go badly. He may, of course, be disciplining his own people, but the curses and the wrath of God are much more serious. And we are urging unbelievers to escape the wrath of God, and we're urging believers to know that they have escaped the wrath of God. That's what we're seeking to do. Why do you think the blessings are so brief in Deuteronomy 28 and the curses are so long? You know, is God more interested in cursing than blessing? Is he more sadistic than kind? And I think the answer is that the promises and the warnings that come to us are both gifts from a kind God. We know this from Hebrews, don't we? The writer of Hebrews is obviously a great pastor, representing a great pastoral God. And so all the blessings and all the curses and all the warnings and all the promises all come from a very kind God. You think of the parent who says to the child who's 6 years old, wait at the school gates. This is my one instruction. Wait at the school gates and I will pick you up. And then the parent says, don't forget. Don't go with somebody else. Don't walk home. Don't despair. Don't hide in the classroom. Has the parent suddenly become sadistic at that point? Not at all. All of it has come from a very loving and gracious parent. Only one instruction, stand by the gates, but lots of warnings, not what not to do. And I think this is the way we must understand the blessings and the curses of Deuteronomy 28. They're coming to us from a loving God. Moses, of course, is quite concerned for the people, but that's because God is concerned for the people. That's Deuteronomy 28. The next section I've called Warning and Wooing, and this is Deuteronomy 29 to 30. And I can only say to you that Deuteronomy 29 to 30 are really wonderful chapters. They deserve to be read and thought about, especially in your own pastoral work of trying to challenge and woo people to Christ. And they reach their goal in chapter 30, verse 19, choose life, says Moses, just as Joshua said in Joshua 24, choose this day. And remember, Elijah said, choose, it's going to Yahweh or Baal. And Jesus said in Matthew 7, choose narrow road or broad road. And Moses is beginning this great appeal, choose life. Now, he's actually asking the people of God to either dedicate themselves for the first time if they've been slackers, or to rededicate themselves. In other words, he's saying to them, I want you to ink in your position, sign on the dotted line. It's a little bit like Romans 12. In the sight of God's mercies, in the light of God's mercies, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. I want you to give yourself to him. That's what Moses is saying. And in Deuteronomy 29, which we didn't read, but let me just tell you as a summary, he gives two negative reasons for choosing God. The first is so that you don't decline into carelessness. Give yourself to God, he says, so that you don't go backwards. And the other thing he says is give yourself to God so that you don't become a byword among the nations, so that you don't become the sort of people who the nations look on and say, what went wrong? And then in Deuteronomy 30, he gives two positive reasons for choosing God. One, God will use you for great good, become an instrument in his hand, and God will strengthen and build you up in your faith. Two negative reasons, Deuteronomy 29, two positive reasons, chapter 30, for choosing God. He says in Deuteronomy 29, verse 2, when you were children, you saw great wonders from God. But then he says in verse 4, you don't get these wonders. Can I just read this to you? Deuteronomy 29, verse 2. Moses called Israel and said to them, you've seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and to all his servants. You saw that when you were children. The great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs and the great wonders. Verse 4, yet the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear to this very day. Isn't that an interesting thing to say? Like saying to your congregation, you've heard stuff from me for years and years and years, and you don't get it. Like Jesus saying to the crowd, you saw me turn the loaves and fishes and feed a crowd, and you don't get it. It's got nothing to do with baker's delight. It's got to do with the bread of life, which is me. You don't get it. You kind of saw, but you don't get it. And that's what Moses is saying. You saw, but you don't get it. And he's appealing to them to get it now, to enter into a covenant with God, to wake up to yourselves. Literally, he says, I'm asking you to pass over into covenant with God. You're about to pass over the river, and I want you to pass over into covenant. I want you to stop being a nominal. I want you to stop being on the outside. I want you to stop being aloof from God. I want you to now cross over, to pass over into covenant with God. And he warns them in this chapter that there's going to be many idols, which are going to be a danger. He warns them against the whole idea of pretending with God, saying, I'm going to go my own way, but all will be well. What a relevant verse that is. I mean, is that not you in your normal moments? I think I'll try two paths today. We're capable of that, aren't we? And he says to them in Deuteronomy 29, don't destroy yourselves. You know, why will you die? And if you do, he says, you'll be a joke to the nations. The nations will look on and they'll say, this Israel is a disaster. What went wrong? And the word will come back, they disobeyed Yahweh. They basically botched the plan that God had for them. So Moses, I think, in this chapter is at his creative best. He's marshalling everything he can. He cannot appeal to them as New Covenant people because they're not New Covenant people, but he does warn them against drifting into deadness and becoming a byword for disaster. Do you not find that sort of slightly stimulating, that little summary that I've just given you? I think it's just worth thinking about how Moses drew all the arrows in his quiver to get people to respond. Now, I want you to notice, as we just look at the end of Deuteronomy 29, the very last verse. How many of you know 29:29 off by heart? I'm sure you do. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed are for us and our children. That, my friends, is a verse that you must keep on the front burner, or at least the back burner of your brain, Deuteronomy 29:29, because there are going to be many times where in your pastoral work you're sitting with somebody and you're going to say something to them like this: I have absolutely no idea why this has happened. I wish I did. I wish I had a magic wand. I wish I could make everything well. But just because I'm agnostic about what's happened, I'm not agnostic about everything. I'm an agnostic about what's happened, this tragedy, but I am a dogmatic that God is on the throne, full of love, full of wisdom, full of power, and is going to work everything for our ultimate joy. And so this Deuteronomy 29:29, secret things, revealed things, is a huge key to us in our ministry, because so much of our ministry is saying, I don't know, but I do know. I don't understand this, but I'm absolutely sure of this. I can't tell you how many times this has helped me, not just to quote the verse, but the principle in pastoral work. However, this is not what Moses is talking about in this particular context. In 29:29, he's not saying to them, I'm sorry you've had a tragedy, but I'm now talking to you about what we can be sure of. He's not in that issue. What he is saying to the Israelites is, sure, you don't know everything, but what are you doing with what you do know? And I think this is a fantastic verse for a evangelistic talk sometime. One day when you've got to give a talk at a men's dinner, take Deuteronomy 29:29 and just spend a little bit of time talking about what we don't know. And then talk about what we do know. It's an absolutely wonderful principle. It's a great talk text for an evangelistic talk, to be able to stand up and say, listen, there's a whole lot of things we don't know. I completely agree with you. I have so many questions, but I do not have questions about whether God is real, because he turned up. And therefore, I'm going to tell you what he's like. But there will also be a day where Deuteronomy 29:29 will be that key pastoral principle as you sit with somebody. Remember when I was at Layla Park, we had a couple come to church with their two kids, and I shook hands with them at the door. And he said, we've decided to come back to God. He said, my wife has a very serious cancer, and we've decided as a family that we're going to come back to God. And I said, that's wonderful. I'll come and see you during the week. The next day, he was the administrator of the Borkham Hills Private Hospital. He went up in a helicopter with a pilot and a photographer to take photographs of the hospital, and the helicopter crashed, and he was killed along with the others. And I had this job of going up to see her, who's dying of cancer with two small children, and her husband has just died in the helicopter crash. Her name was Debbie Bills. I always remember this. And I sat with her and I said to her, thinking Deuteronomy 29:29, I have absolutely no idea why this has happened. It just seems to me to be all wrong. But I do know this. And she's basically said, I completely understand what you're saying. You know, I'm not expecting you to explain this, but I'm so grateful you're telling me this. It was a very wonderful moment. And I took his funeral, and then I went overseas for 12 weeks. This is just an aside. And I said to her, I'm going to be away for 12 weeks. You may well go to the Lord while I'm away. And she said, what day are you coming home? And I said, I'm coming home on June the 9th. When I came home on June the 9th, after 12 weeks, the phone went. It was the hospital. And they rang to say, I'm ringing for Debbie Bill. She wants to know if you've arrived home. She'd waited the whole 12 weeks so that I could take exactly the same funeral for her as I took for her father. It's just astonishing. So I'm just telling you, this pastoral principle of Deuteronomy 29:29 is very wonderful. Well, now, in chapter 30, and this is a word to the people of God when they do fall and fail. The Lord says in chapter 30, when you return after you have fallen, he will restore you. Even if you go into distant lands, and he must, of course, have not known that they would end up in Babylon, but he says, even if you end up in distant lands, the Lord will bring you back. And then this passage, which Mick read for us from chapter 30, verse 11, this wonderful evangelistic passage. You know, you don't need to climb up to heaven to find out what God's saying to you. You don't need some heavenly ladder to go up and work out what he's on about. You don't need to cross the oceans and go to other parts of the world to find out what God is on about, because the word has come near to you. And no wonder Paul quotes this in Romans 10. You don't need to climb to heaven and do something supernatural to know what God is saying. And you don't need to cross the oceans. The word has come to you. Literally, the word, we would say, made flesh, has come to you. He's come across, he's come down from the heavens, and he's come across the oceans, and he has made himself completely clear. And so Moses signs his signature in chapter 30, verse 19, choose life. Because, verse 20, the Lord is your life. That's his climactic moment. Now, the next little section I've called Death and Judgment, but I do want to say to you, reading 29:30 is a very precious thing to do. 31:32, in these chapters, Moses hands over to Joshua. He calls on the people in chapter 31 to be courageous, and then he calls on Joshua to be courageous. He says the law is to be read regularly, every 7 years, to all the people and all the children. The law is to be read. Then God speaks to Moses and Joshua, and he tells them, look, you need to be aware that the people will turn away. There will be disaster. And he says to Moses, I want you to teach the people a song. And the song is in Deuteronomy 32, and it's a very long, depressing song. It's all about being sinful and God being merciful. So we've just sung a song which is one of those lovely, encouraging songs of the Lord being with us. But every now and again, it wouldn't be a bad thing for us to write a song about how rotten we are. Can you imagine a long 8-verse song about how corrupt we are deep down, and therefore how much we need the Lord? I have a godson who got leukemia and died after a 12-year battle, and he found it very difficult to come to church because the songs were just so upbeat and he was so in such distress and pain. And all the jolliness of the songs was too much for him. And he had a sister who was a great songwriter, and she wrote a long lament for him, which meant a great deal to him. So Deuteronomy 32 is a long song about sin. I tried to preach this once, and I divided it up into a whole lot of words beginning with R, that they were to remember their sins as well as God's mercy, that they were to remember that they were rebellious, that God was a rescuing God, that they were a rejecting people, that if they were to relent, that God also would relent, and ultimately they would rejoice, because at the end of the song, he has made atonement. So that's what 31 to 32 is about. It's handing over to Joshua, calling on the people to be courageous, Joshua to be courageous, and then God saying to Moses, now I want you to write a song which will help them to remember that they need me. And now the last little section this morning, everybody, is what I've called Great Hope, Deuteronomy 32 to 34, and I'm especially wanting to say this to you. I wish I was Moses speaking to you about going back to your work, because you're going to get in your car. And preaching conferences can sometimes be very depressing, because you go and you think, well, all these people have got it together and I'm such a weed and I'm driving back to a mess and I don't know what to do and life is rotten and I'm going to walk in the door and hear all the problems of home. And that's just life, isn't it? So here is great hope in these verses. Deuteronomy 33, Moses blesses the 12 tribes one by one. You remember that Jacob in Genesis 49 blessed his 12 sons one by one, and here Moses blesses the 12 tribes. He has a special word for each tribe, and there's probably a PhD waiting to be done in these blessings for the 12 tribes because they're quite mysterious. But in chapter 33, verses 26 to 29, four verses, he has something to say to all of them, and I'm going to read to you what he says. I'm sure you're familiar with these verses as well. 33, 26 to 29. There is no one like the God of Jeshurun. That's a nickname for Israel. It means the upright one, who rides the heavens to help you, and in his excellency on the clouds. The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He will thrust out the enemy from before you and will say, destroy. Then Israel shall dwell in safety, the fountain of Jacob alone, in a land of grain and new wine. His heavens shall also drop dew. Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty. Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. So this is what Moses says as he winds up to the whole of Israel. He's so keen to bless them. I do think this is very wonderful that Moses is so keen to bless them. They've been such a nuisance. They have been a pain in the neck. And he longs to bless them. And why does he long to bless them? Because God longs to bless them. And he says, there's no one like your God. There is no one like your God. There is no one like your God. He rides quickly to help you. And you may say to yourself, well, he hasn't come as quickly as I would like him to come. But I assure you that he stands like a parent on the sidelines watching you play your game of whatever it is, netball or rugby. And he works out when it's time to come in with a stretcher and when it's time to leave you to play. In other words, he's there. He's very present, but he's not helicoptering you out of everything. He's not inactive. He's not reluctant. And he rides to help you. God, as somebody has said, is not a small boat trying to desperately visit every harbor in the world. God is the central land of the world to which every little boat needs to come. So where is God right now? Well, we would say he's masterminding the creation and he's masterminding the new creation. We don't, of course, understand what the great field marshal of heaven is doing. We're just tiny soldiers in our trenches. But we've learned to trust him. We've learned to realize that he has a huge issue on his hands. And he's given us enough information to go on. And he, verse 27, is your refuge. The idea that God is up there and you're down here is not really a biblical idea in the sense that he's transcendent, but he's also immanent. And we need to remember that he's the refuge. So he's above you, verse 26, he's on top of everything, but he's also around you, verse 27, like a lover embracing. He's not aloof. Verse 27, he's underneath. You cannot sink so low that he cannot sustain you. You can't go so low into sadness. You can't go so low into sinfulness or humiliation or trial or death. Nothing can go lower than his hands. And his arms, as you see, are everlasting. They're not like Moses' arms that got tired. Moses remembers when his arms got tired. God's arms do not get tired. And verse 27, he's ahead of you. He's already worked out how to go ahead of you back to your work. He's already worked out how to deal with things and how to help you deal with things. And he's got things that he works that he has planned for you to walk in. So he's above, he's around, he's beneath, and he's ahead of you in the work. He's with us in the fight. He's not the bed that we sleep on, because we're not meant to be just asleep all the time, but he's with us in the fight. And all of this language about being above and around and beneath and before is a sort of a preview of the New Testament language of being in Christ. We remember that the fight that we're in has been, in a sense, already won. Colossians 2. He has disarmed the enemies at the cross. He's taken the swords out of their scabbards. And even though leaders may move on, like Moses moves on, the Lord does not move on. I found it's an interesting time in retirement. You leave a place after 30 years, and Ian will know this, after 22 years, and you think to yourself, I hope they remember me. And then after a while, you begin to realize they've moved on. They're excited about their new minister, and you're just a distant memory, and a lot of the new people don't know you at all. But the Lord, of course, he's the one who runs the church. He's the one who runs the parish. And we come in for a time and do some sowing and some watering. And that's our part. Let me finish with some words of Spurgeon on this lovely verse underneath of the everlasting arms. He says in one of his sermons, if you had 50 kingdoms burdening your brain, if you carried the politics of 100 nations, or were loaded with the cares of 1,000 worlds, you might safely leave them with the wonderful counselor and go on your way rejoicing. So lean hard, brothers and sisters, because underneath are the everlasting arms. It's a great way to finish a sermon, isn't it? And that's how I'm finishing as well. Okay, God bless.